Hello and welcome to a new episode of the isolation specials of my podcast, Helium Talk. Yes, it's true. Finally, I get a new one out. I spoke with Jascha Jung last week, and this is a deep and long one. I know, it has been a while. I published my last Helium Talk about a month ago, my very philosophical chat with David Chillinglaw. Thank you for all the great feedback you send. I'm happy to know that there seems to be a point to these episodes. It is so good to hear from you. This way, it is not just a one-way street, and I love to read your comments, praise and criticism, of course. Please keep it coming by mail to hello@heliumtalk.com or on my Instagram @heliumcowboy. So the world still exists, and in some countries, like here in Germany, the lockdown measures are loosening up a little. It is still an insanely weird situation for all of us, and nothing really is over, so I can still only hope that you're all okay and have found a way to deal with this on a personal level. Don't let it affect your sanity. In the cities of my country, people now go on the street to demonstrate against our government's restrictive policies. And against Bill Gates, because he apparently seeks an antidote to be able to inject us all with a chip to monitor us, and then kill most of us for a less populated and richer world. Well, these people seriously have problems, so again, please stay sane and keep helping others instead of making the stupid ones powerful. I feel like talking a bit today, sorry about that, I hope you don't mind. Here's a little update. With the gallery, we're still trying hard to push a business that is suffering brutally like so many others right now. As I mentioned in the past intros before, Melvin and I do everything to make it through this and to be able to keep the space open to show our artists' work and to make sure that there is a place to go for our visitors to see them in the long run. We had a very special opening on April 30. It went for 10 hours straight, from 10 in the morning till 8 in the evening. You had to book one of three places that we offered every half hour, so we had a total of 60 visitors and gave all of them a personal tour that day. With the mask on, of course, and the appropriate distance. In between, I made three live tours on Instagram. That was good, though I do believe there's just too much online content to watch anyway, so it was very nice to be able to have real people in the gallery again. It was highly appreciated that we did it this way, and yes, it was a very long day, but it was also a lot of fun, and it really felt liberating. The gallery business is tough, though. And a bit depressing, really. Despite this little breather we created for us and our guests recently. We also launched our new online showroom that is a really great way to experience and even purchase the artwork online. It is built on the database of probably the most professional tool on the gallery market right now that we've invested in, so we can at least reach out better digitally. In general, Melvin and I are still keeping up the good spirits and continue to hustle hard for now. But I'm not known for bullshitting people or for sugarcoating anything, so I can honestly say that the thought of giving up the gallery is creeping into my head from time to time. Slowly and silently and mostly in sleepless nights, but still. In the end, it is all a matter of how high the price will be. And I don't just mean money. There's a lot more at stake here. I have been in this business for decades, and I'm not sure I need the second Uber financial crisis once again in my professional life. If you'd all know how hard it has become to convince people that buying art from young and mid-career artists is the right thing to do and the best way to maintain this part of our culture, you'd have these thoughts too. And it's not that it has been easy before, but now, well, go figure, spending money on art in times like these, it's not the very first priority, and I absolutely understand that, of course. Okay, this is a very long intro, but I just had to say these things. As a reward for listening so far, I have this great talk for you today with the wonderful Jascha Jung. Jascha has been in the art business for a long time. She had her own gallery, Strychnine, in three major cities. She was the director of the Art Fair in Cologne. She was in charge for the creation and realization of the Urban Nation Museum in Berlin until last year and is working on several huge projects since, including another museum. A true global citizen, she was in her apartment in New York when the pandemic started and has made her way to Berlin only recently, where I spoke with her from a distance of roughly 300 kilometers, of course. So here we go. Please enjoy the Helium Talk episode number 77 with Jascha Jung.
Helium Talk.
So how are you, Yasha?
I'm good. I'm tired today, but I'm good.
So we moved this around a little bit because when I first asked you to do one of these isolation podcasts, you were in New York still.
Yes, that's correct.
That was basically during the outbreak.
Yeah, and that was during the outbreak, and that was something else, yeah. I mean, it was, for me, I keep saying this again because people are asking me, you know, and for me, it was quite the experience because I'm a very lively person, and I'm a person that moves around consistently and is surrounding herself with people all the time. So being forced to be inside for 2.5 months alone was quite a challenge, but an interesting one. I learned a lot and I did a lot. But I'm still blessed because I was in a big apartment. My apartment in New York is like an old 80s apartment that I haven't left since then. And so it's an apartment that is home to me. Everything's in there and I have space. And I was alone in 3 bedrooms. That's a luxury, you know? And yeah, so I was really blessed because, you know, I made sure I closed my bedroom in the morning. I didn't enter my bedroom all day long until I actually went to bed. I forced myself to sit in my office for 6 hours, like be really in the office.
And get out of the jumpsuit.
Absolutely. No, I absolutely, like if something I learned is like start the day, like make your bed. Mm-hmm. Make your bed, have that done. And then go. And so I closed the door. I didn't want to get lazy. I got up every day like I usually get up. I get up at 5:30 in the morning every day. And then I'll do yoga from 6:30 to 7:30. So I transformed my living room into a yoga studio for myself. Mm-hmm. And then I'll just started doing things. And that was interesting. My apartment is squeaky clean.
Yeah.
My books are organized from A to Z. My stickers are organized from A to Z.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, it was good. But it was also showed me something I love about New York so very much is community amongst neighbors. My whole house kind of became one big family. And although we weren't allowed to, talk to each other or mingle with each other, we left each other food. Like we have an elderly person in the building and we made sure that we went shopping. The kids got online art lessons from me. So it was fun. That was fun.
Okay. What were you doing in New York when you were there? Were you on a project or?
Yeah, I'm just developing a couple of projects there. So I was there and I'm there since November. So I left Urban Nation in September and pretty much moved there right away, moved back. Mm-hmm. In November, and it was very busy time, you know, we were doing a lot of projects, and then but in one shot it was like no more travel, oops, boom, borders closed, so there you go. But it doesn't matter, as a producer you can always continue to produce, you know. Yeah. There's a lot of things you can do without being on site or without being in that actual country yet. So again, another blessing. I feel that I can do my job and parts of my job.
Hmm. So you just mentioned you left Urban Nation last year to embark on a new project. Urban Nation, you did for how long? I mean, that's been quite a while.
My God. So the concept I wrote, what seems like now 100 years ago, the idea of building that was always in my head and I had the concept ready, but I came back to work in 2012 is when I started it, and I left last year. Yeah, correct. So 2012 to 2019.
So you left it because your job was done, or?
Because the job was done. I'm still connected. I'm still, you know, curating the biennials, and I'm still keeping a close eye on what's happening. But number one, yes, the job was done. You know, I built the museum, I started the collection, I built the Martha Cooper Library, I built the residency program, I started the biennial, I've done all the One Wall projects, I've done the Project M's, I established the production office as a youth workshop. So there wasn't anything else, and I think you need to have proof of concept, you know?
Yeah.
So if you don't leave, you become one of those people who cling on and you grow old with it, and it's not inspiring. And that's not me.
Well, I think it's a different, if it's, you know, if it's your, you know, your family company that you found, that you, you know, sort of probably, which is probably nice to cling on to and pass it on to the next generation. But in your case, it's more like a huge project. And who's running it now?
Oh, I don't know. I really don't know. It's my position doesn't exist anymore. So there is no creative director. I think they go with my concept of, it's still part of the foundation, and I think they go with, you know, when I started, I always thought, let me get different curators in. Like I got, you know, Jonathan in, Brooklyn Street Art, who had never curated before. I got them in, and I got graffiti prints in, and Rom from Street Art News, and what's his name? You know, and lots of people who I just thought, you know, it would be great to have their vision as part of the big vision. And I think that's what they're trying to keep doing, but they're not doing it on an international level as much as I did anymore. I think they're going to focus on, you know, keeping it in the neighborhood and trying to first get their hands around what is a museum and try to figure out how to run something. So it's interesting to see. We'll see.
Yeah. But wasn't that part of the initial criticism sometimes, that especially from people from Berlin, that it was too international, which is kind of an odd to say that loud, but
no, I don't mind criticism. You know, criticism comes either from people who are jealous or from people who don't understand the concept. And I did incorporate a lot of Berlin people and a lot of national people. I just think, you know, I think there were a lot of people who probably resented the fact that I was the one to start this, something that they may have thought about it as well. And it's not a unique idea. It was just an idea in my head for a very long time. But you know me, I'm in the business for 25 plus years. And, you know, naturally, it was a progression of my career. I had that in my head. But I think, I think also sometimes, and I will remain strong with this, what I curated was very special. And I wanted to curate an overview historically over everything that had happened. And the street art scene is not the graffiti scene. And I think it was a lot of graffiti people who were like, what is happening there? You know, why is this happening? Because I worked with every street artist in Germany that was, could have been part of the project and helped people go on and forward. But again, I think, you know, I take criticism always with a smile, because I think it's nice if people think about a project long enough to criticize it. And, you know, here you go. It's yours now. Go ahead and make something out of it. And I also think the idea, you know, where did street art start? It didn't start in Germany. And the history wasn't based in Germany. And I think everybody benefited from the fact that I placed it as an international institution. And I would do it again exactly like that.
I mean, the things that for me, street art is something that doesn't necessarily have borders, like art. I mean, there's definitely certain styles that are regional, but in its whole, as a movement, or I don't know, as an art movement, you know, I think it's very hard to limit, especially street art or graffiti, to one country. I mean, there's always an originator. Maybe it comes from some places, but you've had these talks with people who, older German graffiti or street artists who worked, you know, sort of in the last years of the East Germany, of the DDR, you know, so, and they developed something totally different than in the United States maybe at that time. But there's always, it's always difficult to put, I don't know, a physical boundary on these things. So,
well, I don't think art has a physical boundary. I agree with you 100%. And I think every curator, and that's ultimately what I am and remain, has their vision on the subject that they're dealing with. So I did my vision of what I thought would be the most comprehensive overview of a scene, of a movement, and so on and so forth. If someone else can do it better, be my guest. There's no harm, no foul. But I did what I did. So that's
sure. It. Yeah, but I mean, it has a good reputation, and I haven't been there and. You know, actually, the last time I was in Berlin was the time when Jonathan was there, Nichols was there. John had this exhibition at the space.
That was part of the project, and it wasn't in the museum, but it was in the project space, correct?
Yeah, so that was the last time I was actually in Berlin as well.
God, this is all very long ago too, yeah.
Yeah, it's a long way, long way.
You should go.
Yeah, I have no business in Berlin. I have a house in the countryside. I mean, that's, you know, I mean, like, when I have some time to go somewhere. I mean, really, I have no business in Berlin. I'm not dealing with any. I'm working with a few artists from Berlin, but, you know, not in the capacity that I was before when we were representing artists. That's different. Yeah. You know, when you're really representing an artist from Berlin, it's great to go there and to meet and, you know, but I'm not doing that with anyone from Berlin right now. And so I rather spend my time somewhere else. I'm not the biggest fan of the city itself. I mean, as a recreational point, I've been going to Berlin for many, 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 many years, for decades, you can say, you know, since I was very young. So, and I don't know, right now, there's nothing that really interests me, which is probably, it's not arrogant, it's probably just a lame excuse because I'm just not wanting to go to Berlin. I don't know. The countryside where I'm going to almost every weekend or almost every week, there's just so much more rewarding. It's also
each
nice.
One especially, its own.
Yeah, it's also very nice. As much as I still love people and like to be around with people in the gallery or so when I'm coming to Hamburg. Now, during these days, it's kind of okay because everything's a little bit more quiet. But when you're really in the countryside, there's nobody. That is really, really nice too.
Yeah, and I enjoy that
when I'm in the city, I sometimes miss the quietness of no one around. So, yeah, but okay, that's something else. But so that was the last time actually that I was there, and was a little bit also in the beginning, I think, of the whole Urban Nation project. So, but okay, you left Urban Nation, and you have now, I mean, your Instagram account, one of them is Yasha Young Projects. And that is basically, but that wasn't there while you were doing Urban Nation. That's something that came up later.
No, it was the account I started, but it's all my work on there. And now this is my next project. So naturally, I just keep going with this project. Yasha Young Project just means that, you know, I'm doing so many different projects. I'm building collections up for clients. I am an art advisor for big corporations who want to build up their portfolios. I do independent curatorial projects. I do independent, you know, commissioned projects. And I can't possibly do an Instagram account for all of them because I'm not a big fan of social media to begin with. I understand it and we need it and it's great, but I think one is enough. Mm-hmm. And I think on that account, you can consistently, you know, see not only the art I display, but also where I am, where I'm going to be, what I'm going to do. And this is pretty much the cheese bell of the whole what I'm doing. And then through there, you can discover other channels that will give you a more detailed view on the individual project. But I think that's enough. I've just started to connect a Facebook account, and already that's driving me bonkers bananas. I don't want it, so I keep it with one account. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty much a one-way street on the whole Facebook thing now. I post stuff from Instagram there.
Yeah.
And then I have my son and gallery manager to take care of the people reacting to responding to that.
See?
So
there you go. Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah. Family business.
But it's the thing is that you kind of, especially in these days where so much is, not COVID days, just every day now that we're living in that is so full of information that, you know, so not just that you're receiving and that you're trying to select for yourself, it's also the information that people like you and me send out in the world. You know, there's a lot of information. And how many channels can you really properly maintain without, you know, losing so much? You're in one point, I think, I mean, of course, you're so much better in social media because you reach thousands and thousands of people more than I do. But we have one thing that we're still doing wrong on Instagram. We use many words. People don't like words anymore. And, you know, sort of, I like when you write long texts because I'm probably one of the people that actually reads through them. But that's probably just, you know, sort of, I don't know, us. I don't think that everything can be made in that image.
No, I think first of all, I love to write, and mm-hmm. I love to let people know my thought process behind it. Mm-hmm. I couldn't care less if you read it or not, but if you do, I'm so blessed, you know, and I mm-hmm. say thank you so much for reading it, because that's a blessing if somebody has longer than 11.2 seconds, which is the yeah. average. That we spend, the maximum actually that we spend, which I just learned in Harvard, which blew my mind to begin with. But I think it's important, if I have a channel and if I do it, that I actually state clearly what I want to say and why I want to say it, and not just, here's a picture, yay, you know. I don't. I have a reason why I'm doing it. I have a reason why I'm doing a project. I have a reason why I traveled somewhere, or why I want to support an artist. And I actually find it quite rewarding, because you'd be surprised, like when I do put my thoughts out there, I'm so surprised at how many people actually comment on it or have something to say. And that's so interesting to me sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, you can write a blah, blah, blah text, or you can say, okay, listen, read this, because it's something I'm really wanting to share. And then it's super interesting to see, oh my God, somebody actually read that and possibly even had an opinion. And I like that. I like that exchange. But if I would do that every day, and if we had to engage in that every day, writing back and forth, I think that would be a whole day for me.
Yeah, you can lose a lot of time doing that. But yeah, but I liked your text that you wrote about the pressure that's being put upon us all, basically, you know, because we're looking mostly at screens, and we see people doing workshops, and everybody's giving lessons, and everybody's self-improving in every aspect of life, and nobody's just taken, nobody, but sometimes there's so much pressure that we forget that this is also a time to reflect, you know, and to just probably do nothing for once, and maybe gain those 5 extra pounds or 10 extra pounds now, you know. It's like, and forget about improving your work skills.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I just think, yeah, that's exactly.
But I like the text. You know,
thank you. Thank you so much. I was just receiving 2 emails in a row informing me about the things that I should do. And I don't know why it rubbed me the wrong way that day. But I was like, no, I should not do anything. You know, I shouldn't. I should just try to acclimatize to the situation that I'm alone in Berlin now, that I'm doing a project, you know, somewhere in Saudi Arabia. At the same time, I can't reach anyone there. I have to speak to my people in New York. I want to be with them to see, like, I have to deal with stuff, change situations, new circumstances, new productions. That's enough already. That's enough. But then on top of everything else, I have to be thin and fit and beautiful and a proper baker and a great, you know, I don't know, home organizer and yoga mistress. I don't know. But I can't, and I don't want to. Yeah. Yeah. So I just felt like I have a big backbone, and I'm quite a strong character, love me or hate me for it. But that character helps me, you know, to maneuver through professional and personal challenges. But I kept thinking, what if somebody, you know, is not in the position to, you know, feel that strong or know what they're doing right now, because maybe they lost their job, maybe it's like completely new, maybe they're really fearful, and everybody deals differently. And then on top of everything else, to excel in all those things in an extreme situation seems just utterly ridiculous to me. And I just want people to take a moment and breathe, really.
Yeah, well said. Yeah, I think, I mean, there's also a lot of people right now, I think, who are just going on these social media channels who haven't been there before. And they're probably just overwhelmed with, you know, so what is flooding at them, everybody's so being so active and doing things.
And I think there's a positive thing there as well. You know, if that's your thing, go for it. Fantastic. If that makes you happy and fills your day instead of you feeling lonely or feeling depressed, absolutely fantastic. And it's a great way for, you know, neighbor elderly people. I love that my elderly people in my life are all of a sudden using magnificently FaceTime even. You know, all of a sudden it works. It's still at the ear, and you still have to say, no, it's here, but it's fantastic. And I love that. Yeah. But I just think it's also interesting how many new formats come out of it, you know, and mm-hmm. how we actually get access all of a sudden to places in artists' lives and minds that we didn't find before. I enjoy mm-hmm. some of the artist talks as well. There's also positive stuff in there. It's just as a totally. you have to be had already to be very selective before mm-hmm. what you were joining and consuming. And I think mm-hmm. now you have to become even more selective.
Yeah, that's true. So what were you doing in Harvard?
I'm still there. Okay. I'm researching a museum of the 21st century and studying on new techniques of looking, mm-hmm. new techniques of looking at art. I'm studying data processing in museums. User experiences. I do study exhibition design through storytelling and different kinds of artwork. So I'm trying to merge a very hands-on, very, you know, do-it-yourself, but 25 years of experience in the world, in museums, as a collector, as a manager, as a gallerist, as an art fair director, and all of this. Building a museum from scratch up, knowing mm-hmm. the pitfalls, knowing what that takes from funding through, you know, day-to-day programming to just the regular things, how to keep a staff and what kind of staff, etc. Mm-hmm. Bring that together with the academic approach of the very large institutions and researching not only possibilities in the future, but also researching where is that gap that still exists between young, underground, avant-garde art movements and established traditional positions. And I want to learn as much as I can because it seems to be an abyss that's never ending. And I don't get why that needs to be. And if I'm not going to change it in my lifetime, I at least want to come as close as possible to understanding where all these differences still come from.
Yeah, I'm going to follow you up on those answers because I'm looking for those too. I think everybody, I think it's a very, very, very interesting and also challenging research topic. You're doing the research for a current project or?
For myself. I will actually leave there with a final certificate in museology. And I'm contemplating to pursue a master's. There as well, but this depends on how much I actually want to dive into the academia versus teaching myself. I already teach at the university, Pop Academy in Mannheim. Mm-hmm. And, you know, also how much I want to do. I'm not sure yet if I'm only the person who will sit still and learn and research, because my fear would be then I become one of the people who loses the view on the whole thing and then just get stuck in one thing. So I think for me, getting the certificate and having the opportunity to exchange with those phenomenal people there and then leaving again, apply the learned, and then maybe come back later, it sounds like the better way, but I haven't made up my mind yet on that one. I know that I will teach and I know that I want to continue to teach and pursue a professorship at the UdK, definitely stay with the Pop Academy in Mannheim or start teaching independently. I don't know yet, but I do want to teach.
Yeah, no, it's sounds like a good plan. And I think it's, I think it would be perfect for you. Yeah, that's one thing. I mean, you study all these things now, but you already have which you mentioned earlier, like this very long career and in the arts, you know. So, but did it all start with Strichnin Gallery in Berlin back then, or was that?
No, it's because
you were running a gallery for
three galleries for 15 years. Yeah, I had Strichnin Galleries in London, Berlin, and New York, and I was running them and working as an independent curator. And then I gave up New York and I focused on Europe. And then I became the director for the art fair in Cologne. But it didn't start with that. I think it was just, it started with me being part of a community, you know, part of the same community pretty much that Jonathan was a part of. And then some a little bit more in Europe, you know, pop surrealism, graffiti scene, comic culture, stuff like that was always in my life, skateboard culture. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, music, the music industry was in my life due to my work. But that's probably accumulation of all of that. And that eventually mm-hmm. I just knew that I was going to want to show more work. Mm-hmm. And the more research I did, the more I realized the problems that artists are having with access to galleries mm-hmm. and access to getting exhibitions and access to mm-hmm. finding collectors. And so I think my mission is and was and will always be just to try to create access for people.
Mm-hmm. But yes, but it's still very limited, the access. So are there any solutions that you can already offer, or did you find anything out that, I mean, that's of course, you know, also from my position, also with this podcast, I mean, most people listening to this podcast are artists. Mm-hmm. And one of the burning questions of most of them is also how do I get that access? How do I get into a gallery, or at least into a scene that takes where I'm being sort of taken seriously and or even seen, you know?
So, well, it's always funny. I think it was easier at some point in the 90s. Mm-hmm. In a weird way, because community was a lot more, you had to be there, and it wasn't you didn't have that phone, you couldn't just cancel, mm-hmm. you had to be there, mm-hmm. you had to show up, and to have to get your information, you had to connect with people, and connecting with people meant taking responsibility for relationships, and mm-hmm. people did that, and also people said, you want to do it? Yeah, let's try it, let's do it, you know, mm-hmm. There's of course, naturally, as it is in the world, a shift had happened. And so we have the quick phone call and the quick emoji. And, you know, I don't know if that hasn't contributed largely to the loss of proper, solid, long-term connections. It also depends on the person. Some people are really good at it. Some people really like following up. Some people love staying in touch. Like, I'm one of them. I will, you know, be under the shower and all of a sudden think, huh, what is he or she doing? And then I'll immediately go and pick up the phone and say, look, I was just thinking of you. I think if artists want to break into galleries, the way is still the same, you know, show your work, get connected, be around, be persistent, hone your craft, work on what you're doing all the time. And then there's this little bit of luck that you need to have, that little bit of talent, but it's really mostly hard, hard, hard work. And I think the people that I choose to work with, I think I have offered them a lot of opportunity. And I think that's what I think one can do. You know, you can offer them opportunity in terms of starting projects that you take them with you, that you know this project will be particularly good for this artist's career. This artist has never had a participation in an art fair, so I'm going to choose to take this artist to an art fair. This artist has never shown in a gallery, specifically not with a crowd. So I know that this artist wouldn't pull a crowd, but if I bring the collaboration aspect in and bring a bigger artist in, then that will help. So the responsibility is also with the curators and also with the curators educating collectors. You know, if you have access to collectors, and then you are the one saying, look, this is a new kid. I really like the work. Or just simply, if you have the opportunity, purchase work from artists, then do it. Because I know I have dinners at my house all the time, and people can't see this now, but you can see me. And I have an abundance of work behind me on my wall, big, small, you know. So if I have a dinner and people come, they're like, oh, what's that? Oh, what's that? So educate collectors of new movements, because they also love it. Use your connections amongst each other as gallerists and curators, and kind of exchange thoughts on people, and don't hold on to it so much because, oh, I found him or her. No, just say, look, this kid is great. And this ego, like, I can do it better than you, and it's my artist. It just, I don't think that works anymore. This is like an old school gallerist approach. Mm-hmm. And I think what I would love to see, and I said that the other day to someone in a conversation, I said, you know what I would love to see in this particular time right now of COVID is, you know, there will be galleries opening, big ones as well, and there will be restrictions on how visitors can participate. I'm not a fan of going online and digital. That's beside the point. I need to feel, see, smell, taste, touch art. Sure. There you go. Mm. But I think lots of young galleries, small galleries, may lose their spaces now, and that's a fact, and that's something we have to face. What if the big galleries would say, you know what, that's fine, I'm going to take these artists from them eventually anyway, as they're doing all the work, which is a natural ecosystem. Why don't I just have one gallery featured in my gallery once every quarter? Why don't I give away my space for a 2-week or 3-week? Why don't I give away my portfolio to this young gallery and let them show in my space, because they just lost their space, but I still have a space. I have a portfolio. They may have a portfolio. I get access to young artists. And, you know, this is a wonderful, natural, lovely progression of things. But this can only happen if the ego is put aside and the fear of losing a collector to someone else, which really to a big gallery doesn't make no difference. If your collector spends 40,000 on one piece, 40,000 plus, they certainly can spend 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 grand on an up and coming position without hurting too deeply. So I think this is a concept that I would like to see happen. Is that going to happen? Doubtful, but I would love for someone to get inspired.
Yeah, and I think it's a great idea, and for me personally, but that's something that I've always been saying. It's things like this, and especially collaborations, between the top and the mid level and low and small galleries can be super, super beneficial. I mean, but then it's from country to country. You know how Germany ticks in this regards. There is not just the barrier of money and wealth, but there's also the barrier of is this art? I still have some of these discussions, and if you haven't studied, and you know all these things, you know that you're working with artists who come from everywhere.
Yeah,
the background of an artist is finally represented in the work that they're doing, and not, you know, on a piece of paper or something. Yeah. But in Germany, this still is being held quite high regard. So there, I know a couple of galleries where this would be a nice concept, and it would be beneficial for everyone. But where the barrier would not necessarily be the money or giving away the clients, but it's like, are these really artists that I want to show? When, you know, sort of here, would I call them artists? You know, so I think every country has a different aspect.
100%, but this is, I definitely agree, but I still have the standpoint that, you know, I find it a little bit ridiculous, and I can't help myself, and I'm probably being judged harshly for saying this now, and that's fine, you know, so be it. I do not understand this. An artist, in order to become a successful artist in many of the large galleries, for example, in Germany, you already have to have a paper as a master student, and you already have to have worked with names, and you already have to have collectors before, you know, you have to be an asset before somebody considers taking you in. And you know that's true, no matter what people say. And that to me is just, but that's not about the art then. That is just about making money with the art. So that's about the business of art, and that's fine. But if you're already making a lot of money and a lot of business, just step aside and see if there isn't a benefit in there. If you now support the next generation, the next level of whatever happens. And I also think most of the really established galleries, they say, but this is not art. So then tell me, what is art? What you're showing from the 70s or earlier, that's art. But what they're doing from the 90s or like now, 2000 and up, that's not art. So explain to me why. Because it's not your art. Because you're not familiar with it. So because new techniques and new approaches are not something that you know. So it's fear that makes you say, it's not my métier. I can't really get into it yet. I don't know yet. So I don't think it's art. Because it doesn't go with your regular, you know, it doesn't fit in your concept. And I don't believe in that. You have to rethink everything all the time consistently.
Yeah.
Yeah, also I think especially these times now you have to rethink many, many things. I agree with you. A lot of galleries will not, especially smaller ones, will not be able to survive this. And it's already already been, I mean, it's not like, like if you're, even if you're a mid-level gallery, that doesn't mean you have, you will survive 1 year. You're always dependent upon sales and upon doing exhibitions and being lucky in a certain way.
And also now, and sorry for interrupting. And also now you're depending on, the galleries before, and that's also very interesting. There was no social media, so galleries just had their lawyers and their locked up clients. Now there's artists, like Nuno, who has thousands and thousands of followers and collectors. He doesn't really have to show anymore. He can sit and do commissions for years to come. His commission list is this long. So if a gallery actually gets to work with him, they have the benefit of these collectors and this channel. So artists are very smart, which I applaud, and they turn around and they say, listen, we have to rethink that deal. What's in that 50-50 for me? That's another thing, like, that people are not really dealing with or aware of. It's like there's so many new layers also for the traditional galleries that are coming in.
Yeah.
But I also think there's another danger in there as well. If artists have to think about marketing, selling themselves and their work, collector control, managing commission work, managing social media, managing your profile image. It's a lot of extra work on a creative. So I think the image of a creative changes.
Yeah.
And we will see. I think there's a shift, especially in Berlin. There's a big shift going on. I don't know if you know the Flick collection that was in the Hamburger Bahnhof.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We lost that. Berlin just forgot or don't know. Like, we lost the Flick collection. Julia Stoschek is leaving Berlin with her collection, and she's a billionaire who has invested enormously in wonderful video art, young artists, amazing artists, very progressive. And Mr. Olbricht is leaving the Me Collectors Room. So there is a shift, and it will be interesting to see what will happen.
Yeah, I think when you look at the gallery artist relationship, that's something Jonathan and I were doing a series of my podcasts. We started because we are longtime friends. We started doing one, of course, I recorded one with him, and that was, he was actually, this is our experimental field on how to work online, because the usually I have the recordings in my studio with people sitting in front of me. Sound quality is beautiful. We look into each other's eyes. We can have a coffee. We can even make a break in between or whatever, but it's just so much nicer atmosphere to talk. Well, with Jonathan, of course, being in New Jersey and me being in Hamburg, we developed, we tried out probably every platform out there. So I was pretty well set up for this. You know, a lot of people who do podcasts are trying to find a way how to record this, and now everybody can, before it's kind of difficult. So, but Jonathan and I, we started the series, and because we're both pretty blunt and don't hold back with our opinion, we immediately made a series out of it, which we call Off the Record with Jonathan Levine. So basically we're both talking about, so what's with the business, I mean, and there's one thing that we, when you said the 50-50 percent, we said, let's try and tackle that. But nobody really wants to hear that. We made some suggestions and asked people to maybe, sort of input us with their suggestions. When I speak with other gallerists about it, they're just like, I really have to think about it. Whereas now you're in an experimental phase. I mean, not just now, the years before this, sort of the old gallery model wasn't functioning anymore. The gallery artist relation doesn't work. There are artists that are really good at marketing themselves and market themselves. There are others that cannot do that. And you still need that kind of place where things come together and where things can be shown. And so what can be a new model? And just, sort of attacking the 50-50 model, which goes in both directions. You can go in both directions. You can go in a way that you say, let's make a business where we both benefit from. We both put, like a barbecue, we both put something, everything in, and then we see in the end what we can actually share. Or if you have a group show, if you have a group exhibition, for example, group exhibitions are maybe good for younger artists because they can get a chance to show alongside more experienced or more prominent artists. But it's also always kind of weird when it comes to billing, so, and then you're just like, for me it's always kind of weird, and I have like these 10 artists in the group show or 8 artists, and five of them get money. And the three others don't get anything because they didn't sell a work. Why not take some percentage aside and share that among everybody else? It's easy. It would be possible.
You know, I know, but like you and I are hippies a little bit. You know, it's a different, a different approach. And I think that's what I mean with the shift. I think we'll have to see what will happen because I think we all have to rethink how we're going to collaborate in the future, especially in the term, in the world of art. You know, a lot of the funding that the art has received will be cut completely or will be cut short due to the fact that we have to spend money on life saving and also, you know, existential things for a society, which I understand. However, I am always the kind of person, you know, who has advocated for some form of sharing. For example, I've discussed this with when I was advising the city of Rotterdam for, you know, progressive things to do. I was always advising, why not figure out a system if a large institution manages to get 400 million a year in support from the state, why not put a clause in where a percentage of the foundation or whatever they're getting, whoever is getting it, a set percentage has to be distributed to a smaller institution of the choice of the larger institution, and it can never always be the same. It has to switch, you know? So they have to do their research on what's out there. They have to find a way. There can be a committee overseeing it so it doesn't become, you know, this internal blah-de-blah, whatever. But I think that would have been a great thing to do. But then you talk with large institutions, and I do talk with a lot of people who lead large institutions, and they're like, yeah, but you wouldn't believe it. But I do, actually. Even a large institution is depending on every cent because their overhead is enormous. You know, they have a completely different overhead. Every gallery has a different overhead. If you have a gallery in the middle of London or New York, you have a $20,000-$25,000 rent. You know, you're depending on that money. And these are all layers and layers that need to be discussed and examined. But I think we should do that. Whether we find an immediate solution, I don't know. But I'm of the strong belief the longer you discuss it with peers and artists, the more you will slowly figure out a way how it may or may not work. So I think, and having a podcast like this and chewing on the same bone 100 times, eventually it will weaken. Eventually you'll come to something.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. It's just, I mean, it's. I think as soon as people are too comfortable in their environments and in their business, then it's always very difficult and very hard to change. I've been talking to, of course, I mean, there's when you run a gallery for as long as I'm doing this, and when you're also an artist, and you know, so as an artist, I have collectors who have been supporting me for, I don't know, for almost 20 years, and so there's a bunch of collectors that I'm now individually talking to about this situation, because of course they are aware that things are happening, but I think it's always nice, you know, sort of a good opportunity to tell them how things are on the gallery level with us. And we did an exhibition here. We had to cancel our other exhibition. We did a new exhibition. We came up with a new idea for an exhibition that might work during these times, and we have to figure it out. You know, we're just thinking about outside of the box. These are things that we're doing. We've invested, you know, during these times where everybody saves money, we've invested into a new platform for the online presence and for online selling art. It's all, you know, so also an idea that, you know, sort of the gallery scene, the art scene has to look into how do we get people to accept more buying artwork that they haven't actually seen.
Yeah, and that's a tricky thing, you know, that's a very tricky thing because, you know, I'm a VIP for Art Basel, like a preview buyer. So I always get to enter and see and get all the stuff. And I have to tell you that getting into the online buying room prior, it doesn't do anything for me. And I actually share my opinion with Jeffrey Deitch on this one, who's giving a talk today about that with Jonathan Weiner, about digital and online buying stuff. And I don't buy into it. I think it's a nice thing in order for people who can't be there to see it, but for purchasing, especially first time, if you've never seen a piece of art, that's going to, in a completely different emotional and committed situation.
Yeah, I know, but it has to become a part of the whole sales process, because otherwise the market will not be big enough if people cannot visit galleries. And they have not been visiting galleries to buy in the last year. When we started, I mean, how many shows did we have where we actually sold during the opening, maybe even before, and shows that were sold out? But these last years, it's very hard to even get people to buy some stuff, because the gallery culture has also developed into maybe more entertainment and more, you know, people not really, you know, sort of getting buyers back to buying, that is a new buyers and acquiring new buyers. So it's like, it's like one of the platforms that you have to kind of invest into and see where that can work, but it will of course not replace the actual physical. I agree with you. I mean,
I agree with you. I think digital is going to play a big part in that, 100%. I also think, you know, again, this is something that has changed in the earlier days, especially when Jonathan had Tin Man, you know. But not even Jonathan, because he was very open at the time with his connections and whatnot. But there was in the 90s or earlier, there was not a contact between the buyer and the artist. Yeah. There wasn't a contact. Now the content is available. So buyers come to your show, but they don't want to buy from you, maybe, because they want to have the direct contact to the artist. And they can now, because they can contact artists online. And then it becomes the artist's responsibility. And I have great respect for people that I work with, because they all do that. They're really wonderful people that says, no, I won't. You have to go through Yasha, or you have to go through my gallery, which it shows a huge backbone and integrity, you know. Mm-hmm. But it is a change. And this change has contributed massively to the change in buying behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, having all of a sudden studio visits was never the case. It was something special to go to a studio, and never without the gallerist, you know, and there was paperwork, and gallerists were the decision makers, actually, who could buy. And, you know, I remember going out when I first started buying for corporations, people were like, no, you're not getting it. Who are you? And I'm like, well, my client wants to buy. Who is your client? And I was like, well, I can't really tell you who my client is. And then you have to flush the money. Or the big black card. That's not yours, but that's representative for who you are buying for. And all of a sudden you can. And all of a sudden you come on the first list. It's just a money question. And that makes me sad. So I do believe lots of behaviors have changed. I do believe digital will become part of future buying options. But I do also believe it doesn't replace the one-on-one experience.
No, I think also it's something that, you know, so we also have to develop a new kind of new buyers, you know, like when the new market, when tech money was big, people were buying into young art. Mm-hmm. You know, I had this conversation with Jeremy Fish in San Francisco a few years back, when Facebook had their IPO, when they went public, when they went on, you know, so with a big bang on.
I remember,
on
the stock market.
And I was there. There was, you know, and Jeremy said, you know, your money is there in San Francisco. Now we have, like, I don't know, they had like 250 new millionaires in stock, millionaires, you know, on paper at least, in the area of San Francisco and Silicon Valley alone, you know, so like many, many people. But whereas in the 90s, the money, people that finally, they had money, they were young, they bought this nice apartment, they went to an exhibition because somebody took them and said, wow, this can be on my wall. This is amazing. I'll just buy it. And this is how artists like Jeremy Fish got big, because there were people, I mean, not just that, but that's how he started to get into a market with enthusiastic investors. And the second wave of the tech money, the people were not into buying art or anything. You know, they were not interested in buying art. And so now there's probably, you know, sort of another kind of people we have to approach with, who are actually willing on saying, oh, yeah, I want that, because online buying has gotten so huge. Why not art? And I don't mean the people that go to Art Basel or our regulars who come to the gallery. They probably, if they see something that I've seen before, they've bought a piece by this and this artist, they might buy it online. okay, this is how artsy works, basically. People who inquire and finally go through with the sale on Artsy, because mostly on Artsy you get inquiries, you know, that are probably after your initial response not replied to. That's why I canceled the whole shit, because it doesn't make any sense. I have no personal relation to almost anyone there who inquires. Whereas if I have my own platform, it's my own house, people come to my door and we can talk. So it's a different kind of responsibility, social responsibility for the dialogue as well, which is very important. So I'm aware of the fact that this will not make 50% or even 30% of the art market business. But maybe if, you know, sort of, especially for smaller galleries who can provide the service, like a small manufacturer of shoes or hats or cosmetics or whatever, who just, you know, who sit in their workshop and when the work is done or when they close the shop, they start wrapping, going online and checking the orders online, and they send 10 packages out.
I do believe that there's a value in this. But I also think we have to dig deeper. We have to not only look at that buying behavior, but we also have to look at the market, on what's on the market. And I think another reason is we have to work on, kind of containing the oversaturating of all that art that's everywhere and available. Because we are at a height of, we have more artists, visibility than ever, literally than ever. And I think it's, again, another responsibility to help people to, yes, make money as an artist, but also keep their integrity and kind of limit their output, because limited output generates interest, and it also generates time for the artist to focus on their work. If you put pressure on having to put out all the time, it's the same what we discussed before. It applies for every walk of life. You know, if you have too much out there, people will like, yeah, but he's going to put one out next week anyway. I missed that sale, but it doesn't matter. There's another one next week. And then you will realize you won't sell out your print editions as fast as you did at some point. But also, you know, from an income point of view, I work for a startup that's not a new startup, that's an old startup, Patreon. And I find that very interesting for people, and I'm doing a lot of research and a lot of digging in this right now, and I'm going to be their content curator. So I will feature people who have a Patreon account, and I will go there with a camera team, and I will elevate them, and I will try to, you know, give new life into these accounts and this situation, because I believe strongly that this is a great way for artists to make money. But in order to make money on a platform like that, you have to be aware that that's a job. It's a real job, because then you have people paying your salary. And it's not like people are always like, oh my God, this person makes $35,000 a month on Patreon. Yeah, but that person also records and films and puts out and generates regularly, you know, with a red thread and a reliable rhythm and a reliable price, and manages to diversify on what goes to Patreon clients and what goes to my big collectors. But if you don't know that, Patreon can be pretty intimidating. Platforms like that in general can be intimidating, because they expect so much of your own work to be put into, and then you never know if you get someone, and then you put all that work in and you have to organize it. And it's not everybody's thing, but being an artist is a job. It's a job. And you make your choices how you want to educate, how you want to execute that job. And I think, I will support this, because I think it's great to have direct contact to your client, supporting you all the way, generating time for you to create.
Yeah, I think it's true what you're saying. I mean, Patreon, I think, is, for example, is one of the ways this can go for certain people, not for everyone, but it's work. It's something you have to, I mean, having an Instagram account that might be successful may have several reasons. They don't necessarily have to have something to do with you being super successful as an artist. You might have been at the right time, or you may take part, if you're a street artist, you may take part in a couple of larger projects, and then you're just kind of rotating. It's like tattoo artists with 180,000 followers on Instagrams. They will need several lifetimes to ink all of them, you know, sort of, and travel the world multiple times. But it's like, you know, so it doesn't, it's good for a business of a tattoo artist. Does it help an artist itself? If you have many followers, some may not, because it's also how much do you put in there, how much contact you put in there. It's like, you know, posting a picture is one thing, dealing with the reaction, engaging with people. And Patreon and these platforms like Patreon or any platform actually where you're getting, basically being paid for creating content, you have to do more. And I don't think that every artist can do that, but there is a kind of artist probably more now today that can actually that can actually provide some services like that.
But yeah, and I think it's individual. Yeah, I think it's a job, but I also think it's an individual decision. But especially in times like these, you have nothing to lose. We all have nothing to lose. We all have to see where this is taking us, you know, personally, financially, the future of development, what is possible. And I think look at all the venues and pursue what you think works for you. But in order to do that, you should know about them. So again, to me, everything comes down to education, educating artists. And I don't mean education with a raised finger like you're better. No, I mean education in terms of, hey, look, there's option A, B, C, D. Here is the options. You're going to have to pick one door and, you know, be Alice and go for it. I think that applies for buyers, collectors, collaborators just as much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think that was actually when, you know, so before when I was talking to my collectors, that is something that I spoke to one of my collector who is in a completely different business. Of course, most collectors are in a very different business. And I explained the situation to him that we were facing as a gallery and what were the things we're trying to do and the things that are happening outside other galleries are doing. Everybody's kind of trying, you know, coming up with new ideas. And he said, okay, listen, my business is going to shits now, you know, because it's, you know, I mean, he's in the tourism industry. Nobody's, you know, so if nobody can't even book his boats, it's impossible, you know. So right now they've loosened up the restrictions, but that means he has like 20% maximum that he can make throughout all of summer. That is, you know, sort of less than he needs to keep his float afloat. I mean, you know, so like, but he says, but also we're trying everything. We're also trying different things. And he likes to see what people come up with, the ideas that everybody comes up with. A lot of it is will not succeed or anything. But I think there's also an opportunity now to find new ways of doing things. Yeah. We started with the booking system for the open. We had an opening. And here in Germany, as you may know, people can come to galleries, go to galleries, if they have enough distance, if they wear a mask, if there's one person per 20 square meters, if they don't, you know, sort of. And so we made a booking system so you could book yourself into the opening. And we had the opening for 10 hours from 10 o'clock in the morning until 8 o'clock in the evening. Every half hour, there were three free slots. And we were fully booked. That means 60 people at an opening who are all 100% engaged. Interested. Mev and I, we were talking all day. We're talking for 10 hours.
But I think that's, and I think that's fantastic. I kept telling everyone, look at the escape room. So I'm a big nerd. I like to go to escape rooms. I'm doing it for 10 years. I just love it. I just love to go in there, find riddles, you know, figure out how to get out of the room and go in different worlds. I'm a nerd. I love it. But I was telling this when I first went in 10 years ago, I said to a friend of mine, I said, wouldn't that be something? Because the system of doing that is brilliant. It's brilliant. You can book yourself from 9 to 10 or from 9:30, whatever, you know, 30-minute slots, 1-hour slots. There you go. And I think it's fantastic because also for you as the gallery owner and if the artist is present, it's a great opportunity to actually engage into one-on-one conversation. It's a lot of work too, because you have to be really aware. I've done it for a friend of mine in Tokyo before all of this started. They have a system like that because of the size of the space. They're the big exhibition, but they're not allowed to go above a certain amount of people because of the size of the space. But the artist in there was super famous. So then you have to stand there and all of a sudden you're engaging with 8 people. They're there. And they will talk to you and they will talk to the artist. So you have to be, as a gallerist, you can no longer hide in your back room or whatever. You'll have to be there and be ready to have these conversations. I, however, love it because all of a sudden you know the story about your collector or about your visitor. Mm-hmm. It'll be a great way to form new relationships with visitors. Yep. Is it gonna help in the long run? Mm. Nobody can say, you know, but I agree with you on one thing. What I said before, the innovation possibilities of rethinking old structures now, of experimenting without the failure, the fear of failure, because if you fail, that's just fine. You know, there's nothing else to do. You may fail now. That's okay. And I love that this is actually the time where failing is wonderful and losing a project can be a blessing, because there's a lot of people that I talk to, they're like, you know what, I'm kind of glad that we closed this company, or I'm kind of glad that I'm no longer in this job. It's also an interesting aspect of things, you know. This sure. will offer another way of opportunity if you are an optimist like me. I'm a pessimistic optimist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it will open up new ideas, definitely, for sure, and new ways. Listen, one thing we haven't even, you know, sort of scratched upon, we're always just like, you know, saying your projects. Are there any projects you can talk about right now that you're working on and that, you know, sort of will have an impact on the art world as some of your projects before? Like Urban Nation.
Well, I'm developing a new museum, a new concept for a new museum at the moment that I'm developing in New York. I'm developing an entirely green production for a, you know, massive project in Iceland. So the production is completely self-sustainable. So we're working with the chef from Moby's restaurant on having, it's pretty much like a traveling production that we're doing. We are only producing artwork that's, you know, is either gonna fade over time. It can only be out of non-toxic things, or it has to be permanent, like a you know, a porcelain installation or a steel installation. It's a lot of work. We're eating the food that is cooked there for us. We're doing have several fantastic yoga teachers with us traveling. We're traveling in green buses and electric cars, lots of walking involved, lots of DIY. It's not for everybody. The crew that I picked around this and the artists that I picked around it are people that I know for quite a while that are big name artists, but also newcomers that are ready and willing to say, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to try. We're only going to eat food that's regional and learning from, it's a holistic approach to an existing concept. I want to see what does it do to cost. You know, we're going from using recyclable or completely degradable bubble wrap to using reusable cups. Everything is like, there's no plastic, there's no none of that. And I want to see, number one, how much does it actually raise the cost of a production? Because it does. And then I want to work how to lower. I want to work on who are the right sponsors for this project. So I'm talking to a lot of different companies. Big groundbreaking science companies that have developed some technical advances that I'm going to use for these productions. Also new color developments. I'm talking to a lot of companies, especially in Japan and the US, about new colors that, you know, sustain warmth, colors that actually could become part of our energy system, colors that actually purify the air. There's a lot of things that I'm looking at, that I'm learning of. I'm thinking very much in the future. So that's the one project I'm really in love with, and that keeps me super busy. Apart from that, I'm still curating the Humboldt Forum. I just finished with Hau Nozem. You know, they did the big entry of the Humboldt Forum, which is an unbelievable, impressive artwork, and I hope one day you'll come back to Berlin to see it.
Yeah, I will.
And I've worked with ... and David Mesquish to create sculptures. And we are dealing with the idea of surveillance and Big Brother and the darknet, and how we happily sign away our entire privacy, not even knowing it, but just joining Google or something like that. You know, and we are showing the development from spying on people, especially if you look at the city of Berlin and Germany in general as a divided country, how it went from people to people to cameras, to people, to one-way cameras, to moving cameras, to 360, infrared, retina, fingerprint, facial. So we are going on a completely on a journey through, hey, where are we now? And that is a drone, and that drone is doing this, and you are being recorded whether you like it or not. Like, that's the exhibition. That's a project that I'm doing that's still ongoing.
Okay.
And I'm you know, curating walls. I'm supporting the festival in Switzerland, although I'm not going to be able to go. I'm curating for Vision Arts Festival at the moment. So Queen Kong is going to do something phenomenal over there. I'm trying to become an asset and help people in terms of, I don't need to be there because I'm very familiar with the artist. So I can curate while I'm away. I need to see the wall. I need to see the surface and the structure of the wall, but then I know who can do it. And I know who can execute it within the given time frame and budget. So that's what I'm focusing on. Yeah. And then Patreon. So I have, thankfully and luckily and wonderfully, I have a lot to do, and I hope it stays that way, because I think I would go banana bonkers if I didn't have something to do.
Yeah, I agree.
But I think the research for these projects, whether it be academically through Harvard or whether it be scientifically and new production ideas, is what occupies me the most. And developing a new venue in New York will take another, 2 years. So I'll keep busy.
Yeah, as always. Yeah. All right. That's that's a lot.
Yeah.
It's all on your plate. But it sounds all like, sort of projects that are worthwhile doing. I mean, that's probably where, of course, especially when you're talking to, people on the business side, there's a lot of complaining in the arts. But the bottom line is, I work more now than I worked before, and before I work harder than most other people, I'm pretty sure. But it's the things that we're doing, that we're actually working on, are also pretty worthwhile, submitting so many hours to them. I'm always grateful that I've chosen the path of working in the art world. And
I don't regret it. I think the art world is murky waters. When you look at it as a whole, I think it's Monopoly mixed with a game of whodunit. But I think that I grew up in this world pretty much, since I'm like 20, 21. So I have a big history looking back on many, many artists, many, many shows, many, many things. And for me, I'm entering a phase in my life where I can finally... I don't know how to describe it, but I'm coming into, especially in that period when I was alone in New York, it feels like I'm coming into where I can finally understand my own resources. Because when you're doing and doing and doing and doing, you're doing and you're growing, but you continue to do and da, 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 da. And when I was in New York, I realized, okay, what have you done? Because I'm writing my book about the journey with Urban Nation, and I kept prolonging it, and I was like, I don't even know how to start. And then I sat down and I looked at all the old pictures and, the little Polaroids from the 90s. And I was like, okay, you've actually done this. And then you learned that and you did this. Oh, yeah. And you did that. And remember when you went there and this happened. And so now this time to me, I'm learning to tap into all that I've learned, really tap into. And makes me very happy because now I get a structure and how I'm planning to apply this. And having accomplished what I set out to accomplish also puts me in a great spot where I don't have to anymore. And it's wonderful to be able to say, no, I don't think that, and I don't want to do that, and I'd rather leave now. And when you're in a build-up phase, you can't do that. We all know that. You know that. You rather say, okay, I'm gonna do that too. Okay, I'm gonna help it. I push through and I will. Yes, I can. And now I'm like, no, because I've done that and it made me feel that way, and I don't want to feel that way anymore. So I'm a happy little growing person in my middle age, and I'm looking forward to a lot more of doing a lot more growing myself and learning.
Mm. Writing a book is a beautiful experience to relive these moments.
It structures you, because you forget everything, and all of a sudden you're like, oh yeah, that was 1997 or something, you know.
Yeah, I'm writing a book, you know, so which is also I think almost 1.5 years in the making now, and I stopped writing. That was actually everything I wanted to do until summer. I wanted to write the autobiographical part of that book, which basically was going pretty well until, you know, sort of like the zombie virus came and I had to focus on the gallery more to keep the business afloat and to keep the artist going. And also, you know, sort of I have my staff, which is basically just the gallery manager, but still, you know, sort of, I mean, so there was a different kind of responsibility. Also wanted to take on that challenge, you know, once more. But I just finished, so I stopped writing on the book and I will continue soon. But I just, the where I stopped, the time in my life was this really tough years after the last financial crisis.
2008,
which hit the gallery market very strong. 2009, 2010, a lot of galleries closed. You know, sort of, I had really, really tough, brutal years with Helium Cowboy. And one of my first things that I was thinking was like, I'm not going to do that again. You know, I can leave this space. It's going to be heartbreaking for some. You're going to be, you know, sort of maybe itchy at some points, but I'm at a point in my life, I try this, we do our best. I have a timeline for how long I'm going to do this. If it's not working, it's not going to work. I'll just be an artist then.
Yeah, well, I'm not an artist, so I always have to produce. But for me, it's mostly about finishing things. So I finish things, you know, I finished having galleries around the world. I finished being the director of an art fair. I finished building a museum. Those are projects that I finished. For me, it's about where can I apply what I've learned by finishing these and throughout the process now to being a curator, to manage collections, and to become a better producer, and actually to merge these three together even more. That would be my ultimate dream, to try to merge them together even more. But I think go ahead.
I think it's kind of, you know, sort of with your career, your vita or biography, I think it makes sense when it, you know, sort of more things come together when you finish them. But I've finished being a successful gallery owner, building up a gallery. So I can make a hook into that. It's just, I would just decide to not continue doing this if that means, there's no sense in it anymore.
Dan, I don't think I want to be it anymore. I don't think I want to be a gallery owner anymore. I don't think I want to run another art fair. I really don't think so. I've done it with everything I have, because every project I do, I give my all. And then I learned. And I stuck for 15 years with having galleries because I loved it. And then I took the challenge on being that director of that art fair. And I loved it. And then I learned so much about these traditional galleries and about the mafia business of the art. And then I learned about politics. And then I learned even more about economics. And what I have learned about politics and the people I had to meet over the last 7 years, you know, and what you have to do to get these ultimately really beautiful projects off the ground that benefit a lot of people, and not only the public, but also the people participating, you have to make enormous sacrifices. Enormous. And I am grateful that I made them, and I don't regret it, but I'm wonderfully happy that I have that in my book, check, and I don't have to do it again. And there's people I will never work with again, and I'm happy to say that, you know, and that makes me, it lifts the burden. But the book for me is mainly about, it also has something to do with education, because I don't think people understand what it takes to bring the entity of a foundation, a housing company, local artists, international artists, politics, local, different political parties, cities, neighbors, kids, expectations, internationality, art market, subculture, avant-garde, all genres from performance to film to whatnot together in one spot. I think people underestimate, not in terms of, you know, oh, you don't know, but like, I want to tell people, if you want to do it, here's what you need to be prepared for. And these are the pitfalls I encountered, and these are the wolves that came sniffing around my path, my little house. And these are those storms I had to weather. And these are the beautiful things I experienced. And I want to kind of lay a roadmap for somebody to read it, learn from it, and maybe make it better or make their own out of it. You know, but nobody that I know has built a museum from scratch that I did. So I had nobody to turn to other than very specific, selective people out of these little segments that I was trying to bring together. You know, having a residency program under the roof, having exhibitions, turnaround exhibitions, and a biannual, and work internationally, bring people to Malaysia, bring people to Iceland, bring people to America and Tokyo and whatnot. I always could only turn to one person who had done something like that in their field, somebody who had done a residency program. But I wasn't capable of speaking to one person who did this all, plus found the architect, plus developed the design of the house, plus was there to know where does every plug go, what does the floor need to be made out of, how, what glass, what light, what lighting system, where's the toilet, how is it, not all of that was part of my job. And it was truly gruesome and truly a challenge. So I would like for other people who want to do the same thing or something else to kind of have a roadmap. So I could have shortened this had I known, you know.
When is it due? When do you, there's a publishing, a plan for
publishing? 2021.
Okay.
I hope at the for Christmas.
I don't know. Still on the table? Is Christmas
you know
still
what?
On the
Christmas
table?
Is always on the table. Excuse you me. Like Christmas, no. Birthdays and Christmas is
no,
always
I mean,
on the
now,
table.
You know, sort of. Are we allowed to celebrate it? I mean,
I celebrate.
Just think about one person. You know, with all the parcels around the world going from household to household. You know, like Santa Claus. I mean, it's
I
like
know.
The infection problem.
You feel bad. Yeah, but you know what? Would just apply your system of buying online. Santa Claus gets his own little online channel, and that can work for him as well. And then we have, you know, we have beam technology by that time. So you don't have to worry about going down the chimney anymore, which will be eradicated anyway because of fine dust. So there will be no more fires and chimneys. So we'll just proceed to have teleported presents into the individual bedroom. There you go.
Or maybe this century it will still probably be drones.
Good God.
Santa Claus drones.
No, I'll have,
No. I agree. Yasha, that was very nice having the opportunity to talk finally. We've been planning on meetings and doing this here. Maybe I take my equipment next time and bring it to Berlin when you're there.
Yes,
and we
do
it there.
Too.
So we go when you're in Hamburg, we do it here just in person. You know,
again. I would love to meet you again in person. I mean, I know you over a decade, so I know you for a very long time too. But yeah, keep in mind, maybe when the Humboldt Forum opens, that would be an interesting place to come visit and see this merger. I can't tell you now because of the virus. So it was due to be open in September, but God only knows. Mm-hmm. But when it happens, I'll keep you posted.
All right.
All right.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you
this.
So much. Have a really, really good rest of the day.
Yeah, and you.
Okay, bye.
Well, thank you for listening today. I will be back with more talks shortly. If you have any questions for me or my guests, I'm happy to hear them all. Just send me a mail to hello@heliumtalk.com or a direct message on my Instagram @heliumcowboy. Stay safe and healthy and take good care of everyone around you. Yeah.